generative knowledge that's not a scientist and tell us about all the exciting stuff which is going on there.
Right, yeah. So, well, thanks very much. It's really pleasant to be down here. And had a good couple of days. So, yeah, I'll talk about the Deep 3600 Dark Matter Search and what's being done at Snow Lab. I'm Snow Lab Research Scientist and Adjunct Professor at Emerging University. So first I'm going to give a little slideshow. There's some fun pictures of recent expansions. And then I'll get into so this is a nice little model of Snow Lab. You've got 6,000 meters water equivalent, or 2 kilometers of rock. You get in a cage here, and you go down in the elevator, and you work your way into the lab. That's about 1.5 kilometers. And it's actually not that bad a commute time. It's about 45 minutes to be from surface to ready to work in the lab. So here's a plan of our level. This area here is the original snow area. And this is the expanded lab area. And what I'm going to do is to show some of the highlights. We'll start in Snow Plus and we'll work our way through the experiments. This space here is allocated. And this area in a black dashed line opened up last week. Actually, it's ready for use. So this is the Snow Plus deck. So we are right here over top of the snow cap. The snow is going to become Snow Plus. And so here's the original flask holding 1,000 tons of heavy water. The heavy water was returned a couple of years ago. And it's being prepped to be filled with linear alkyl benzene, which is a liquid scintillator of specific gravity, 86%. So when it's surrounded by light water, it will be buoyant. Okay, and so you need to build kind of the world's largest macrame project and build some ropes and hold down into the ground here. And you have to be a little careful because people who make ropes wash the fibers with potassium hydroxide. And of course, that's very bad because potassium is 1%, potassium 40. Or sorry, not 1%, 1 part per mil, potassium 40. So, we had to get the rope fibers washed in sodium hydroxide, for example, and a lot of care actually went into selection of the ropes. But this work is being done in the cavity, and there's really only one entrance point. It's through this hole, so all the equipment they need, all the drills, everything to get the anchor down, needs to go through that one hole. And there's actually a team of mine safety experts who run a set of winches and whatnot, so that if somebody were unable to get back up under their own steam, it's possible to get them out.
Probably making it a lot more expensive.
Yes, that makes it a lot more expensive. Yes. The people who are trying to do mine rescue don't come cheap. They're very skilled guys. Now, the other thing, too, that's going on is inside the acrylic vessel. And I'll get into this in lots of detail with Deep, but what it boils down to is there's radon in the mine air. It's about 10 times the concentration of radon at surface. That radon has a long-lived lead-210 daughter. The radon daughter's played out on the plastic inner surface of the acrylic vessel, and because the half-life of lead-210 is 22 years, it's there effectively forever. So the inside of the acrylic vessel needs to be cleaned. So this is, from the bottom of the acrylic vessel, a photograph of a ladder section being lowered down into the acrylic vessel. This is a photograph by somebody in a bosun's chair about halfway down taking a photograph of the assembled ladder going up the wall of the acrylic vessel. That ladder is on wheels. It'll go halfway up the acrylic vessel and it can rotate around the axis to allow people to clean the entire bottom half of that acrylic vessel to scrub off any radon daughters or any other contaminants which are there. What you're seeing here underneath the acrylic is the photomultiplier tubes used, and they're in panels, and you can see the reflectors and then the photocathodes in there.
Are these still the original ones?
Yes, these are the original photomultiplier tubes. They'll be used as was used in snow, with the small exception that in order to make room for the hold downs, ropes to hold down the acrylic vessel. Some PMTs need to be removed to make room for the rope. Also, some PMTs that were known to have gone bad during snow will be replaced and swapped out. So, you know, if you need to remove this PMT, which is good, but, you know, that PMT over there is bad, you'll get...
Would you get, like, a shadow from the ropes?
Yes, absolutely. There is a shadow from the ropes, and that's one of the concerns, because the thing about Snow Plus, the double beta decay component, is what you're really looking for is a shoulder on the double beta spectrum, right? So you get the two neutrino double beta spectrum coming down to the endpoint, and then you're looking for a bump, an excess in the spectrum shape at the two neutrino double beta decay. So you have to be extremely careful that you haven't created situations where you can get geometries that give a little more light than other geometries. This is Halo. These are a series of painted lead.
Sorry, I guess I should know what is Snow Plus after?
Snow Plus is after solar neutrinos, double beta decay with neodymium, geoneutrinos, and reactor neutrinos, and maybe a supernova if we get lucky. But it can measure solar neutrinos, the PEP solar neutrinos, and from that, hopefully, constrained theories like MAVENs or non-standard theories of neutrino oscillation or that sort of thing. But it'll also be run with 50 kilograms of double beta decay isotope. And neodymium has a very high endpoint, which gets it away from the other backgrounds. So the idea of Halo is that it sits there and runs. Lead is the target for supernova neutrinos. You get lots of neutrons out of the neutrinos. These are the original neutral current detectors used in SNOW. What they are is helium-3 proportional counters. And the idea is a neutron comes in, hits the triton, and you get NP on the helium-3. And that leaves a characteristic signature inside the proportional tube, so there's an anode wire in the middle. So there's helium-3 plus a quench gas in there.
So if helium-3 plus neutron gives tritium plus proton,
right? Yes. Helium-3 plus neutron gives triton plus proton.
How do you detect it? Just by energy release?
Yeah, so those release energy, those ionize the gas itself. There's a quench gas in there to keep the ionization from running away, so they run in proportional mode. And you get a peak at the full energy, and then you get a tail from losses because the particle can hit the wall of the...
no big energy release in this reaction, right? So you should...
Yeah, most of the time you get the full energy, but these are only a couple inches on diameter, so the edge effects are real. And they were actually made rather long for snow. They were actually welded together as they were lowered into snow and taken out. So they're being, the helium-3 regions are sealed, metal welded shut. But they're taking off the ends on the outside and putting on new end caps for connectors and whatnot. Those helium-3 counters will go in there, and the idea is this just sits and takes data, and if there's a supernova, you get a burst of neutrons, which is read out on the DAC, and you send an alarm to SNOWS. They'd like to expand, get a little more sensitive to doing different types of supernova models, but the idea is it just sits there and counts supernova. Picasso. This is the new Picasso, which is a huge improvement given where they were shoehorned in before. They've got this nice large water tanks full of ultra-pure water for shielding from neutrons. Inside Picasso are these gels. So Picasso is a dark matter detector, and it uses fluorine, which has spin. And it looks for a spin-dependent dark matter interaction. And what happens is the fluorine is in a droplet. See, 4F10, I believe, but it's in a droplet, which is a superheated liquid, and the idea is when the radiation from dark matter or a neutron or an alpha hits that droplet, it locally creates some energy, which initiates boiling, and you get a phase change, which is very rapid. It pops, your bubble pops, and these are piezoelectric crystals on the outside, which pick up sound waves, and you can time back and work out where the you can do finishalization, and you can start the position. Above the detector, there's an oil, so they can repressurize after a certain length of time to condense these bubbles back into liquid droplets. And it can run in steady state, and that's a fun little publicity photo taken with the beanbag wimp on top of the detector. I think that made the CERN Courier webpage.
Can you make a comment on the on the spin dependent limits in comparison with Siemens, for example? And I mean, this detector just sits there all the time. And
yeah, they sit and collect data. I haven't. They haven't published anything recently. So, I mean, I think the limit from their previous papers is all I know. I have very little to do with the council.
But that's the paper we've seen in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
A less serious question. Things like the beanbag, how does things like that get in there? Like, you have to clean everything that goes into the cleaner, right?
That's actually not a... very carefully is how that beanbag went. So yes, it would have been cleaned in some way, and then it would have been put there, and I'm sure they'd have wiped it down with a cloth afterwards, and it would have gotten brought in, you know, sealed up in a plastic bag so it couldn't collect dust. But yeah, you certainly wouldn't leave that there.
What's the density of these bubbles that they have in this detector?
It's a relatively small packing fraction, and that's Coop and Picasso is the same idea. They use the fluorine and they look for the bubbles. The difference in design is Coop has a much, much larger packing fraction in the sense that it's completely full of fluorinated liquid. However, they have to be much more careful about the surfaces. Because Picasso is made with the assumption that your surfaces will be ultimately the background you're worried about. So they put the droplets in the gel matrix. And I don't know the mass fraction, but it is small. And Coop, I don't have a photo of it. It's not very interesting. It's because they're up and taking data. These experiments look least interesting when you're doing what they should be doing. They're just surrounded by water boxes. They're right there. The Deep One prototype is here. I'm going to start showing photographs right about there, where the hallway narrows down. And because it looked like this, it was an emergency escape route out. So, but the far side was officially dirty until about a week and a half ago. And that's Nigel Smith, our director, slicing through the plastic dust screen. And then we walked through this hallway, and if you turn left at the end of this hallway, you enter the cryopit, which is 50 feet in diameter and 50 feet high. Or actually, it's about 65 feet high. It's 50 feet to grade. And there's a crane overhead. And then there's a hallway at the bottom for getting equipment in through a ramp at the bottom. Those of you who are used to looking at spaces in a mine will notice that the two things that are missing is emergency lighting and a fire detection system. But once those two things are in, it's basically ready for people to start doing. I mean, there's a few little bit of work we have to do, but this is unallocated experiment space, and this is unallocated experiment space. So,
did you have power outages once in a while?
Yes. So I'll get to that when I talk about DEEP. We are guaranteed one long-term power outage a year on November 11th. Every year on November 11th is electrical maintenance day, and they basically throw the main switch leading into the entire mine, surface and underground. And the power can be off for up to 24 hours. So anything you build has to be able to withstand that.
And unannounced?
Yeah. And it's cable running through a mine. And, you know, yes, you want to be. But they don't happen much. And we are, the entire mine runs off a 13.8 kilovolt network. And that's always been very reliable. We have our own 13.8 to 600 volt transformers, and then 600 volt distribution systems, which do everything from 600 volts down to 120. So, but yes, we, you know, it is possible to lose power. So we're up to 53,000 square feet of Class 2000 clean room space, and it's not yet all allocated. When I say clean room, a typical dust deposition rate is about a microgram of dust per month per square centimeter, which you can measure with XRF. Assuming that your mine dust is 7% iron, you can find the iron. And we have portable laser-based air particulate counters. And so here is four rooms that are used that we try to keep clean. And you can see that these are weeks. So this is the weekly average for the third week of 2011, fourth week, fifth week. And you can see that our air particle counts are always below a couple thousand, and they're usually below 1,000. So we work very hard at keeping it clean. It seems to be working. Okay. I'll get into the nuts and bolts, dark matter and single-phase liquid argon, sort of deep and a bit of design overview. I'm then going to get into sources of backgrounds and background control, because that's everything. I'll talk about some of the progress with Deep One and where we're going. So this is, dated 2004, published in 2006, in Astroparticle Physics, Mark Boulay and Andrew Heim. We're looking at liquid nobles and realized that argon has this beautiful time constant of 1.6 microseconds compared to a prompt time constant of about 6. And you could use these different time constants in the argon scintillation signals to separate out electrons in nuclear recoil events. Nuclear recoil events preferentially decay in 6 nanoseconds, or create light that decays in 6 nanoseconds, and electrons preferentially decay in about 1.6 microseconds. So you get a nice time signal. And another problem, though, is that your wavelength is at 128 nanometers, so you need to wavelength shift.
Why is it physically in your environment?
What's the physics
different? So the physics behind it is the density of energy deposition, okay? So something like a nuclear recoil event has very high density energy deposition, and there's high density of energy deposition, and what that means is that it changes the ratio of excitation to ionization of the argon, which changes what state the argon, your argon molecular state is in, whether it's an S or a P state. And that is a function of the energy deposition. So something like an electron, which has very low energy deposition.
So is it right that the electrons create a lot more of this low-mid state?
Yes. Okay. Right. So you end up with, yes, so with the low energy deposition from an electron, you end up with much more of the long-lived argon molecule. And that's what's shown here on this log plot, a typical waveform where the fraction of photons remaining. The nuclear recoil has very few photons that decay promptly. Sorry, the number of photons from the nuclear recoil, they mostly decay promptly, And from the electron, they decay, most of them decay late. This is the Mohr scale, which I set somewhat. So what it looks like in a single waveform in deep one, and this is data from deep one, here's an electron-like event, here's a neutron-like event, they both got almost the same peak amplitude, but you can see there's an awful lot more late light. In the electron-like event, this is 10 microseconds from beginning to end, an awful lot more late light for the electron-like event than the neutron-like event. And basically what we do as our discriminator is we take the ratio of the amount of charge in the yellow region to the amount of charge to the total amount of charge over the full waveform, and you end up with this variable F prompt, and it very nicely separates out these two classes. So if you were to build an experiment using this single phase liquid argon, and you could eliminate all the backgrounds so that you would have a background free region in a million kilogram days, which is 3 years for a ton roughly, you would get down below 10 to the minus 46 in cross section.
Can you go back?
Yeah, this is what everyone wants to see. So some of these curves will have, you know, these curves are moving down. The xenon 100 people are going to try to push the curve down. Xenon 100, I think, when they do their full rod mix, to about 10 to the minus 45. If they're...
The threshold is much higher. Is that right? Not sensitive to the light layer.
Right, right.
There's been a lot of action to the left of this plot.
Yes, no, there is. And okay. So the reason for that is that in liquid argon, single phase, to use pulse shape discrimination, you actually need lots of light. Or your counting statistics make the pulse shape discrimination not work. Okay, so that requires that you set a fairly high experimental threshold, which makes you sensitive, really, for the higher WIMP masses.
So what was the original motivation to only have one signal and not a discrimination between two different signals? Is this just because you have to be in this ball from snow, or is that a design issue?
No, we're building our own ball. So the issue is this.
Oh, no, sorry, yeah, that's a different ball.
This is the issue is... The fundamental design idea of deep is that volume is good. You want to increase the volume of your detector, but surfaces are bad because your backgrounds come from or through surfaces. And in the two-phase detectors, you have photomultiplier tubes, which admittedly on the Q-pits are being made now with cleaner and cleaner and cleaner glass and, you know, sorts of stuff, iron and crazy things. But those are immersed in your liquid. Okay, now you can self-shield and whatnot. The idea is we wanted to pull everything away from the argon and only have acrylic and wavelength shifter near the argon so that you could hammer down all your backgrounds. Okay. And that is the fundamental design idea. Everything that is the only thing that touches the argon in here is acrylic and wavelength shifter. Well, it's actually wavelength shifter, but a very, very thin layer and acrylic behind it. And acrylic can be made extremely pure.
But isn't it that for example, xenon, I mean, they apply at risk voltage, they also don't have anything in their detector, inside their detector mode? I mean,
No, absolutely right, absolutely right. But, so, yeah, and they've got regions, and the last time I saw details about this was actually about xenon 10, not xenon 100. But yes, absolutely, they use their grids to define a volume. But they still have physical stuff close to the medium, okay? And the idea of the deep design is that there would be nothing closer than about 50 centimeters, okay? That's about this far from the outer edge of the argon. So you have all sorts of ultra-pure plastic to absorb neutrons, okay? I'm not saying it can't be done other ways, and yes, with the way they set up their voltages and whatnot, they can, you know, try to achieve similar things.
Also, the red stuff is the acrylic?
Yeah, so what we have here in the middle here, while there's 1,000 kilograms acrylic fiducial volume in the 3,600 kilograms of acrylic, on this inner surface here, there is wavelength shifter, which is tetraphenylbutadiene. It's some horrible organic chemical with benzene rings all over the place, which is what gives you scintillation in the blue in the optical, or in the optical in the near UV, is benzene rings, because that delocalized electron can get excited and de-excite in the optical. That's why all your liquid scintillators have benzene rings in them. So that's the TPB. Then there is an acrylic sphere, which is about 2 inches thick. With light guides, it's another inch to about 3 inches thick. Then there's a series of light guides, which will be bonded to the acrylic sphere, and a filler block material to block neutrons from the PMTs. Outside of it is a steel shell, which is actually the safety shell. Okay, the acrylic vessel is not, the acrylic vessel is not for life safety. Okay, we don't want it to break because that's our experiment. But the steel shell is what provides the life safety. And then there is an active watery Cherenkov muon fetal. Up here is the cooling, and I'll get to that in a minute, but there's a series of coils here which is used to cool. And I'll talk about that a little bit later on. So that's the fundamental design idea. The only thing near the acrylic, or near the argon, is acrylic and TPB.
And there the intrinsic radio improved is very well understood.
I'm going to bore you to death with about 4 or 5 slides of that, because it's how I've been spending my life. So our goal is 0.1 background events in 1 ton in 3 years. Okay? So here's a summary of the background. So surface events. Basically, alphas and nuclear recoils from the surface activity in the acrylic and the TPB. Okay? That can create light in the liquid argon. Once the entire thing's built and sealed up, we'll insert an automatic resurfacer that will, basically it's a small little robot that'll move around and clean the entire surface. And that'll remove any radon daughter activity that came on during construction or that penetrated into the acrylic during construction. We very carefully control bulk contamination in the acrylic and TPB, and we'll also use reconstruction and finitialization to beat down the surface of our backgrounds.
I got another one of the nice stupid questions. How exactly do you resurface and remove radon?
I'll get to that. I'll show you that. I just want to quickly let me summarize all the backgrounds, and then I'll go one by one into how we beat them down. Radon emanation from your process system, or in your argon gas, right? You can't chemically remove radon from argon. They're both nobles. So we'll have a charcoal filter operating at minus 150°C. We will do things like have seamless tubing and careful control of valves. That doesn't mean opening and closing them only at the right times. That means you buy the right valves and you make sure you do radon emanation measurements of your valves to make sure that there's no nasty welds. Because if you just go get a typical welding rod for an electric arc welder, it's 2% thorium. And of course, we don't want that. So we actually gamma count our individual welding rods before we use them to make sure that they really are clean enough. Neutrons, alpha N from acrylic, PMT glass, steel shell, or block wall. Again, radioactive control. The light guides are nice and long so that the acrylic will shield those neutrons. And the water tank keeps the neutrons from the rock wall. To get rid of the cosmic ray-induced neutrons, we go underground. And we have the active muon veto. And we use the pulse shape discrimination to get rid of our gamma backgrounds, and in particular betas from argon 39. Problem with this is there's a tension between this and this, because we need lots of acrylic to block out the neutrons. However, lots of acrylic means you've got a longer optical path through acrylic, and we need high light yield, so we need very transparent acrylic, as well as being very radio pure. So this is the uranium chain. At 4.5 billion years, The last long-lived isotope is radium at 1600 years. And then you go to radon-222 with a 3.8-day half-life, which is just miserable, because it's long enough that the radon can eke out of places and move around, being a gas, and short enough that it's still reasonably active. You then go through a whole series of fast decays until you get to this lead-210, which has a half-life of 22 years. And the problem is, beyond the lead-210, this is the usual chain, beyond the lead-210, you have a medium long-lived polonium, 138 days, which decays by alpha. Okay? So this 22-year half-life means lead-210 is there forever. Okay? So if you have radon somewhere, you've got lead-210 there. And that lead-210 is there for the lifetime of the experiment. So what we'll do with our resurfacer, and I'll show you a picture in a minute, but radon can penetrate about 0.1 millimeters into acrylic before it decays. So our resurfacer will go through and it will scrape off a 1 millimeter thick layer of acrylic under clean atmosphere. Here's how the surface backgrounds work. So this is the liquid argon, this is the thin TPB layer, and this is the acrylic layer. If they decay in the bulk liquid, that's great. That's 8 MeV, 7 MeV, 6 MeV. We see it, no problem. This is potentially bad, and we're doing careful studies of alpha scintillation of TPB to see if you have high energy particle physics, 8 MeV.
No, I was just saying it reminds me of the discussion of CREST, because they also had this problem with surface decays.
Yeah. And but the alpha scintillating the TPB may have a different optical signature, and we're measuring that carefully. It's promising, but we can't say anything definite yet. But this is potentially very bad because you've got a nuclear recoil in liquid argon, which is exactly our signal, a nuclear recoil in liquid argon. Decay from the TPB surface going the other way, if the alpha particle goes into the liquid argon, then we're probably okay, so that's the full energy signal. But this is potentially bad because the alpha can lose lots of energy and only trickle into liquid argon and give us a lower energy signal. So these are the kinds of surface events we need to worry about. TPB does scintillate, but not nearly as much as argon. So, and there's also less of it. So, once we've built this acrylic vessel and we've got our vacuum system running, what we're going to do is introduce through a series of vacuum flanges this resurfacer with its arm rotated up. And it's going to go down the neck of the acrylic vessel. And it has a series of drive motors, it has some spring loaded machining pads. And it is going to rotate around this way, and the arms are going to move down. And as it rotates around, this machining end and this just pressure end, to keep it centered, they're going to go around, step, go around, step, go around, and remove material. We'll use ultra-pure water to rinse that material off and vacuum it all up. So that way, anything, so our acrylic has been sitting here for months while we're building the detector, there's radon in the air decaying, penetrating into the acrylic about 0.1 millimeters. We take off a millimeter. All that radon during the construction phase is now washed away, and the surface activity is the bulk activity. Okay? Now, given that, what is the bulk activity required? For uranium-238, well, one part per trillion. This one is just downright frightening. The lead-210 requirement is 10 to the minus 8 part per trillion. Okay, so we're into the thousands of atoms per mole kind of thing, right? That's an incredibly strict requirement. So if you take our low background germanium detector and put as much acrylic as we can put around it, we get a limit of about 10 parts per trillion, and then we run into our background counting problem. So what we need to do is somehow concentrate the contaminants. And this is a test tube furnace. So what we have in here is actually this small boat with a chunk of acrylic on it, a few grams in this test case. Actually, the two furnaces down here. And what you're seeing is the vaporized acrylic working its way through the system until it encounters this cutting torch where the vaporized acrylic is burnt. It's combusted because you don't just want to release any acrylic vapors into the air. It stinks even at levels at which it's not dangerous. And you're left behind with smudges of black stuff, which is your contaminant, and a little bit of ash left over. And the idea is you then can count that concentrate. So we're building a rig which will allow us to vaporize and then incinerate kilos of acrylic in an ultra-pure quartz oven on an ultra-pure quartz boat. And then we take the ash and we put it into a germanium well counter, where we'll count it with much higher efficiency and we'll be able to measure it. Now, if we really wanted to go after the polonium or the lead-210, what we'd need to do is take this. It would probably need to be a very special boat, which we would then wash with something nasty like hydrofluoric acid, which is just unpleasant stuff. And then count the concentrated acid mixture using some technique like ICP-MS, which might give us the ICP-MS is good to a part in 10 to the 15. If we can concentrate this down to by a factor of 10 to the 5 through reducing the acrylic, and as long as we don't introduce other contaminants, we can probably reach our measurement goals for the lead-210. But that's a really tough job with ICP-MS even. And that's... Now, the good news is you can actually do it with acrylic, and this is why we use acrylic. Acrylic is a polymer, polymethyl methacrylate, and there's acrylic here. It's used to protect your laptop screen. Lots of acrylic goes into thin sheet like that. Acrylic goes into paint, all sorts of industrial uses. Plexiglass, of course, is acrylic. Lucite is a brand name for acrylic. So all these things are acrylics. It's very useful stuff. MMA is a liquid made in the petroleum industry in plants like this. And this is Thai MMA, which is a factory that we visited. And they were very open to us, and they showed us how their processes work. The nice thing is it's completely closed, sealed system, and it ends with three rounds of distillation at this particular plant. And of course, distillation is the gold standard for purifying a liquid. Okay, however, the problem is that in order to inhibit polymerization in their plant, they introduce a small amount of oxygen. Oxygen is a polymerization inhibitor. And they do that by letting in a little wee tiny bit of air. So it actually turns out if you go through the entire process of the raw methyl methacrylate through their process, the way it's taken out by Reynolds, RPT Asia, they're the people that built the snow acrylic vessel, and go through the process, we actually come up to about somewhere between 10 and 50% of our allowed lead-210 budget just by having exposure to atmospheric radon. And then they take the liquid MMA, they add some salt and pepper, which they don't tell you about. Well, the ones they do tell you about are ultraviolet inhibitors and a few things like a mold release, so they can take the panels out of the molds when they're done. And they pour it in between glass sheets, and it's cured for, I don't know, depending on the thickness of the sheet, maybe 8 days under heat. The process must be completely free from dust and other sources of uranium and thorium. That's straightforward. And it must be low in radon. But once the panels are made, radon exposure is okay because that only gets in that tenth of a millimeter. And we can take that tenth of a millimeter off. We visited one factory, that's RPT Asia and Reynolds Polymer Technologies. Asia factory. There's another factory that we're considering, and the acrylic purchase is now out for public bid. So once we have the acrylic in large rectangular panels, this is fun. They'll be thermoformed into 5 orange slices. And basically, thermoformed means you make a mold and you press the acrylic under heat. So you heat the acrylic up so it kind of partly the bonds, making the polymer soften up. You take it above its so-called glass transition temperature so that it's plastic and you can form it into shape. And you do that under heat so it has a chance to de-stress and then cool down. And then you end up with spherical orange slices, which they will bond together into a sphere with the collar taken off. The collar and the neck have to be made in separate pieces because we can't get the entire detector in the cage to get it underground. You can only get it this big in. So that's our acrylic sphere. And these are stubs for the individual light guides. Okay? And that's going to be a really big machining job. The University of Alberta bought a mill for the OHC, which they're not using anymore. So this is actually the cutting tool holder on the mill. And yes, that is about as tall as you are. And this is the jig holding a smaller acrylic test piece. So the piece is held still and vertically like this. And this mill can move forward. It's a 5-axis mill. So a 5.5-axis mill. So it can rotate, it can move in all sorts of different directions. And of course, it's completely computer controlled. So that acrylic sphere is 1.7 meters across, okay? So it's basically got to sit, the entire sphere has to sit here, and this jig can rotate around so that this jig will allow it to rotate around so that the cutting tool can machine on all those faces. That's a huge, huge job that you've got here, right? So we go through all that work, we use the cleanest plastic in the world. So the steel in your chair is probably part per million uranium and thorium. A very good plastic, you know, made with like the plastic pipes used for the snow water system are about parts per billion. Acrylic is parts per trillion that you can get. So it's very clean stuff. But even with that, we need a further factor 10 to the 3 reduction from fiducialization. So the entire radius of our sphere is 85 centimeters. If we use a fiducial radius of 55 centimeters, which is a ton, and if you're just naive about it and draw a Gaussian at 85 centimeters with a radius of 10, with a sigma of 10, you get about the right amount. We've done some work developing a charge based maximum likelihood fitter that does not yet contain all the physics. It's optimistic in the sense that we don't use any time information because light does take time to travel across the detector. It's pessimistic in that charge resolution of PMTs is not included yet. But so far it's looking pretty good. This is in millimeters, so that's 10 centimeters right there. And you can see that it's the distance between the generated event and the reconstructed event is nice and small. We did a simulation of a great many events uniformly distributed over the surface. And what you see is the neck, where we have fewer PMTs, of course the resolution is much worse. Here, where we have some holes to support the acrylic vessel inside the steel shell, the resolution gets a little bit worse. But if you just draw a sphere centered at the origin and ask what mass of acrylic is included, well, the fraction of surface events that leak, if it's 1 in 1,000, would actually cut us in about 1,700 kilograms. Or equivalently, if we ask for 1,000 kilograms, according to this very preliminary study, we're at about 2 × 10⁻⁴ leakage of surface events in. So this is very promising, but no, not at all certain. This work isn't finished yet. But it does make us expect that it will work. Um, The optics of the acrylic is, was a fairly substantial project for a postdoc at Queen's. You need good photon counting statistics to do the PSD, which means you need good optical transmission. To get 10 to the minus 10 pulse shape discrimination with argon, you need 120 photoelectrons or more. And if you're going to have a 20 kilovolt electron equivalent threshold, you require 6 photoelectrons per keV. So the light guides must be very, very transparent, and what we want is a transparency or an attenuation length integrated over the spectrum of light produced by our wavelength shifter of at least 4 meters.
So, can I ask you something? So, is there, would you have absorption of this scintillation light when you travel? Is a detector volume crucial? I'm thinking more in terms of, for example, xenon 1 ton, right? I mean, they have a threshold because they can use only a few.
So the beautiful thing about liquid nobles is they're transparent to their own scintillation light. You see, something like Camland or Snow Plus, the scintillator absorbs and re-emits its own light. But because the liquid noble is made from this unstable molecule and the rest of the liquid is just atoms, it's a noble. The medium is transparent to its own light. Now, there is Rayleigh scattering, but not absorption. So you get conversion at the TPB, and you can actually have a quantum efficiency of that greater than 1 because it's hard UV light coming in and it's blue light coming out, so you can still conserve energy emitting 2 blue photons. But then you do get absorption in the acrylic. And because the light guides are yay long, we need to make sure that the light guides are made out of very good acrylic. So this is should make you think back in horror to second year optics. But what it is a it's a spectral photometer with dual beams, so you can check the stability of your lamp at all times, and you've got continuously running with the reference. And if you put samples in of various thicknesses, and they're only so large, but here are the acrylic samples, you can build an extinction curve, and you can extrapolate it back to zero, and you get the effect of reflection at the surface, just like you should, out of third year optics. And this is a sample result at 405 nanometers. And then what you do is you do this measurement at many, many wavelengths. And for a sample of acrylic, you can get the attenuation length as a function of wavelength for different acrylic samples. And we have many more samples than this. So this plot illustrates the general point, but the actual values for the samples are out of date, so I hit them. This will be coming out in the paper. So your TPB peaks at 420. So even though you've got lots of transmission up here, what really matters is getting transmission early on. So in fact, this red long dash curve is the best. Now, the interesting thing is you'd think that ultraviolet transmitting acrylic would be better. It's not. It starts out better, but if you basically let any ultraviolet light on it at all, it'll degrade the inside of the plastic, and that makes it worse for transmitting the blue light because you've degraded the plastic. So in fact, adding an ultraviolet stabilizer and an ultraviolet absorber improves the quality of the acrylic in the blue. So, in fact, ultraviolet absorbing acrylic is what we need, and it's also what Dye Bay uses. Okay. So the good news on the light guides is that we have samples of acrylic with the required attenuation length, and the contamination requirements are 10 times less severe and are based on carbon 13 alpha N. So those of you who have been following Camland and the geoneutrinos out of Camland, the background to the geoneutrinos before the acrylic, or before their scintillator purification went in, was alpha N on carbon 13. Okay, so you got alpha radioactivity from uranium, thorium, lead, whatever. And carbon 13 is 1% of carbon. And it's, of course, it's carbon 12 plus an extra neutron, which is relatively loosely bound. So it's an excellent candidate for alpha N. And Sanshiro Onomoto wrote all this stuff up and worked it up panel one beautifully. So the acrylic light guides are up for public bid, and we'll bond them to the acrylic, and then the PMTs will be coupled to the outside of those mineral oil. So that's what that'll look like. These will be bonded here. This is a thin layer of mineral oil held in with a couple of O-rings, and then you get nice optical coupling all the way to the PMT. And we've tried that and it works. In deep 3600, the light guides will just continue out like this. For a small prototype detector, the light guides have to be a little smaller. So they're out. We're going to use 255 Hamamatsu R5912 HQE PMTs. It's about 35% peak photocathode efficiency. They're pretty good tubes. And we'll read them out at 250 megahertz with waveform digitizers. We're using the Kane D1720 on Deep 1, and I believe this is out for public bid now, too. So, which means... You don't want to know. The public bidding process, no. The university does purchasing. Their purchasing department, if it's more than a certain value, it has to go out for public bid, period. Now, understand that we have probably spent more money on DEEP on the equipment and the postdoc salaries measuring the acrylic optics than the value of the purchase, okay? Like, the R&D effort is comparable to the cost of the acrylic. Doesn't matter. You still have to go out for public bid even though you've done all this work. So you very carefully write up specification documents. The purchasing department puts it on a website. They are allowed to notify preferred vendors. Okay? So you're allowed to have preferred vendors, but it must go out for public bid. And
the question is, who decides then?
Who decides? The university purchasing office. And there's a financial threshold. So yes, Queen's University of Alberta are doing most of the purchases for DEEP. So yes, it's, and one has to be extremely careful. So when I say it's up for public bid, I'm actually not allowed to comment now in too much deep. Well, I mean, I can with you guys, but if the company asks a question, they're not allowed to ask us. They have to ask the purchasing official who forwards it along. And we write an answer and send it back to them. Okay. It's extremely, it's very good at preventing fraud and corruption, but it's hard. A quick note, just very quickly, calibration. You first do no harm. At the Low Radioactive Techniques Workshop, Greg Kiefer from the University of Alabama showed a frightening plot from Camland in which he showed the radon decay rates as measured by bismuth-polonium coincidences lower down in the chain. He showed that decay rate as a function of time, and he marked on it when calibration sources were inserted in the detector. And every time they inserted a calibration source, the radon rates went up measurably and then decayed away with the appropriate half-life. So we will use the internal argon-39, we'll use surface events, external sources. And the other thing I want to do is shine a 266 nanometer excimer laser light down the neck. It won't penetrate the acrylic, but what it'll do is it'll excite the TPB at the bottom of the detector, and that'll give us a spot source of light, which, if you like, is a green function for the response of the entire detector. Process system, the SAES getter, which we use on Deep 1, is beautiful. It'll take part per million contaminant argon, turn it into part per billion. So it'll scintillate, and we'll have a nicely automated, cooled radon trap. The point of this flow sheet is not for you really to look at it. The detector is over here somewhere. It's to show you how few lines there are on it. And that's deliberate. The more lines, the more complication you put on it, the more welds you get, the more chance you get for uranium and thorium. we're going to cool this thing with a thermal siphon. Okay. Now, the way a thermal siphon works is imagine, well, this is a vertical one, but imagine this is hollow and sealed at the top and the bottom. And I've got a charge, say this much liquid nitrogen in it. Okay. And based on the pressure in this tube, the pressure determines the temperature at equilibrium at the liquid-vapor interface, right? Because that's how thermodynamics works. So once you've got the pressure fixed and this thing's in equilibrium at the liquid-vapor interface, you know its temperature. I've got liquid argon up to about here. The heat from the liquid argon goes into the thermal siphon, boils the liquid nitrogen, which shoots up to the top. At the top here, not shown in this diagram, several feet above, we've got a large dewar, and this penetrates into a liquid nitrogen dewar, which is kept very cold. So the liquid recondenses up there and runs back down. So heat from the argon goes into latent heat of the liquid nitrogen, which shoots up the tube, which gets recondensed out in a large dewar, and then it flows back cold. Fortunately, the density of liquid argon as a function of temperature is quite a strong function. So as you cool the liquid argon along these cooling coils, that liquid argon is much denser and it falls to the bottom of the detector. And we've actually done three-dimensional CFD, which stands for computational fluid dynamics, calculations to prove that the liquid argon is in fact going to flow. We have to take out 1,000 watts. Actually, 800 watts is the design spec. So that's you need a lot of coolant to take that out. You asked about power failure. It would be really bad to lose coolant. So our liquid nitrogen dewar in which this thermal siphon penetrates has enough liquid nitrogen to last for 4 days and keep the detector cool for 4 days. And there are cryocoolers on top of it continuously operating, but if the power goes out, of course, we lose a cryocooler. If the power goes out and we can still get into the mine, we can always top off our liquid nitrogen because we have a liquid nitrogen tower on surface. But it's one of the things we've thought about. What happens to the argon if the power goes out? This is Deep One. It's a 7-kilogram prototype. There's an undergraduate student of mine from Waterloo. And this is what it looks like in schematic. 7 kilograms liquid argon, TPB in here, light guides, PMTs. And just let me just say what we've accomplished. We've got a light yield up in our last year's run to about 4.7 PE per keV. So that was very good. And what that tells us is that our light yield and our light guides and our photomultiplier tubes are working as we hope they will in terms of collecting lots of light. The other thing we've learned in Deep One is that our prototype radon trap, and this small little thing, which is only about yay big and yay big around, has about 1,000 square meters surface area of charcoal in there. And we cool this to minus 110 C using ethanol ice slush. You guys made ice cream? You know that business that if you cool the ice cream and keep stirring it, you don't get crystals forming, but you get a nice, well, creamy texture? You can do the same thing with ethanol or methanol. And you use liquid nitrogen as your coolant. You pour it in and you stir and you pour it in and you stir. So it's done by hand on Deep One. Deep 3600, our trap needs to be colder, so we're going to design a liquid nitrogen-based system. But basically the idea is that minus 110 C, van der Waals binding energy, the radon on the charcoal, is large compared to KT. So it sticks. And so this is what happened. This is July 4, I think this is 2008, when we filled the detector. Actually, we filled the detector about here. You can see that we had a radon decay curve, 4-day half-life. When we topped up the detector with more argon after we had a venting, we got a nice radon decay curve. In the next generation of the detector, well, two things happened. Our background rates went down a factor of 10, so the scale is now much expanded. But you'll notice that there's no radon decay. So that was beautiful. Our radon trap worked lovely. And the other thing is by using the tubes, we can know where the events occur in Deep One based on center of charge. And then when we went from our Generation 3 detector, which is the dots as a function of position in the detector, We had something crazy going on in the windows of the detector based on our model, which we don't completely understand yet, but we think that light is from outside the argon. In fact, we're quite confident that light is from outside the argon. And then there was a bunch of events in the middle of the detector, which we understood to be coming from the neck of Deep One. When we went to our Generation 4 chamber, which was improved to get rid of the neck light, and we hoped the window light got rid of this end, but not this end. But our background rate in the center of the detector went way down, again, about a factor of 10. So in April 2006, when Mark Boulay ran this in his basement at Queens, we were at 20 millibecquerel, and now we're at 10 microbecquerel, roughly. Don't quote me on the 10 microbecquerel. If it were 20, and I told you it were 20 in 6 months, it's 20, but it's certainly not 100. It's somewhere between 10 and 20 microbecquerel. So that's very good. If we took our Deep One background rate and said and scaled to the surface area of Deep 3600 and drew those events with our fictitious 10 centimeter Gaussian, we would be able to have 530 kilograms background rate. So even if we don't make any more progress on backgrounds, we've got a 500 kilogram experiment. So That's very good news. I won't mention the plated argon. Where are we? The short answer is we're buying stuff. On lots of slides here, I said, this is out for bid. This is out for tender. We've bought our cryo coolers. Construction starts soon, and it's time to make this actually happen. Lots of things I haven't mentioned. You can imagine what fun it is. Worrying about oxygen deficiency hazards in a large room with that much liquid cryogen. You know, when that stuff boils, it's heavier than air, and it settles at the bottom of your cavity, and the, you know, there's all sorts of things to worry about. But anyway, lots going on. Thanks for your time.
You didn't show us a study with how well the pulse shape discrimination works.
Yeah, I've been thinking about other things. So, I figured somebody would ask. So this is three runs. This is the surface run, which is on the archive in blue. The black is the underground run we did in 2008, same data acquisition system. The red is with our new waveform digitizers that we use in the large detector. So you can see these shapes, and they're all normalized to one. Okay. If you were to take total up our events, we have about 110 million events in those histograms that I've shown you from the three data runs. And you can get, we use TAG gamma rays. Okay, we use a sodium 22 source which emits a positron, so you get back to back 511 lines. So you get the back PMT and you get the light in Deep One. The time of the TAG is about 40 nanoseconds. Okay, so you've got 40 nanoseconds timing resolution on the tags. You've got a finite window size, which means that the background in the detector allows some probability that with a tag open on your back detector, you will get a background event in deep, which will mimic leakage. So we would expect in 109 million events to have about 0.45 pileup events. Okay, and just by random chance, that look like neutrons. And indeed, we got one. So here's a histogram of 110 million events. The neutrons sit above 0.7. So it varies from run to run exactly what the neutron acceptance is, but it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 75%, depending on which of the three runs you look at. And we have one event, which is a background, which is completely consistent with a background in the detector, accidentally in coincidence with our gamma ray tag. So we've done this quite well, but we're at kind of 10 to the 8 level, which is at what point we got background limited. With our much cleaner chambers and reduced background, we could probably do a lot better than that now. The key thing to doing better than this with Deep One, though, is getting the electronics noise way down. So we want to get this as narrow as possible, because if the slope of this line, because of other sources of electronics noise or whatever, opens up like that, it becomes much harder to make a measurement. You keep the slope of this line going down nicely, we'll be able to meet, you know, as this is, we'll be able to meet our goal. So we've seen nothing which indicates that it isn't good enough, or that it's not going to work. We're pretty close to the right data that if we use depleted argon, we're almost at the point where we can say the PSD is good enough if we use a depleted argon, where depleted means a factor of 20 reduced in argon 39.
Could you do something like, I mean, once you know your backgrounds very well, that you lower the threshold and require less other electrons?
No. And the reason is this. If you have the amount of pump light between 0 and 1, the electron band looks like this. Centered at about 0.3, say. And the neutron band looks kind of like this. As you reduce the number, well, there's energy and there's the number of photons detected. Okay, so now, of course, the energy and the number of photons detected are linearly related to each other. But the energy affects the energy deposition density. Okay, as you get a lower energy electron, it's not minimum ionizing anymore, and you start getting high energy, high density of energy deposition from the electron traveling through the argon. So you start increasing the number you start decreasing the number of long-lived state and increasing the number of short-lived state.
And
similarly for the nuclear recoil, so that they actually kind of meet it at about 0.5 in the middle or something. So the pole shape discrimination depends linearly on the energy. However, it depends exponentially on the number of photons, because that's your counting, right? Basically, you're looking at the size of the tail of your counting statistic distribution. So if you go from 120 to 100 photoelectrons, you radically lose ability and pole shape discrimination. And you can see that in the distribution of background events, right? It really does turn up like this, and you have to get above that threshold. And the way you get above that level is by having enough photoelectrons and making darn sure that your electronics noise is low. And I think I said 20 keV. This is our energy threshold is about, assuming we can get 6 pV per keV, which I'm confident we can get there. I'm not sure how much beyond that we're going to push, but I think we will push a little beyond that. This is 20 kilovolts electron equivalent. So yeah, if we got 8 pV per keV, we could push our threshold down a little bit. Okay? This 20 kilovolt electron equivalent is roughly 60 kilovolt recoil. Okay, so the energy threshold is lower compared to
0.3 points.
Yes, roughly 26% for 30. Now this is one, well, putting positive spin on us needing a high threshold is we do know that our nuclear recoil quenching factor, we know it very well, and it's been very well measured. The Yale group using a keg, using a neutron source and neutron detectors scattering off the argon and running some Monte Carlos, have shown very nicely that the nuclear recoil quenching factor is somewhere between 25% and 30%, I forget the number off the top of my head, and flat. So that's beautiful. that makes that part of the analysis easy. Unfortunately, it makes the analysis easy because our energy threshold's high.
Questions? So,
Yeah.
Some of these members of your corporation, most people here, they also think of detecting coherence between the neutron and the nuclear. Not that small lab, obviously, but next to the SNS. So, detectors.
Yes, so
can I have a question. Can you take, say, some of your prototypes and put next to SMS and just try to at least detect positively any tumor because is it possible?
I have to say I have not thought about it at all. Now, part of the point of CLEAN, and DEEP and CLEAN are, if you like, sister experiments, part of the point of CLEAN is to use a liquid neon program and they want to. Now, the full-scale CLEAN is 100 tons of liquid neon, and one is they do like solar neutrino spectroscopy down to ridiculously low energy.
Are that based on elastic scaling?
Yeah.
Now, the question is, like, neutrino nucleus elastic scattering, despite being coherently enhanced, never been measured.
Right? Yeah,
so you can put the, I mean, one of the guys in the collaboration, right, is actively promoting this idea of CLEAR, right? I mean, it's similar
right.
technology, but you stick it next to SMS.
Right.
To a huge neutral.
Yeah,
and
unfortunately, I'm the wrong person to answer that question. I mean, yeah, there are all sorts of interesting
that things. That is at least a guarantee, it seems, right? The room scatter is not a guaranteed signal.
Yeah, but yeah. Wimp scatter is it's a signal that changes how you think about the world, maybe.
Yeah.
The problem is if you don't get any of those detectors out of the lab anymore, at least the big ones.
The big ones, no, but I understand, right?
Yeah. No, there's a lot of really interesting things being done. The Yale group, Dan McKinsey and company, do all sorts of interesting work with liquid nobles, and there's actually very long-lived states of liquid helium. They can track flow using it, right? I mean, they can. You can look for decays of liquid helium and you can have it travel large. I mean, they can do all sorts of crazy, wonderful stuff with these different detectors. And
question? If not, then let's thank Chris again.